The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, a once great rivalry reduced to a damage limitation exercise on Merseysiders, Liverpool see off Manchester United and effectively clinch the league title in January. Hooray! Unless you're not a Liverpool fan. It's down the cherries in all departments as Bournemouth continue to sink without trace, just as Norwich, Burnley and Watford find ominous form. Plus, Wolves mount a miraculous comeback against Southampton. There's a great weekend of football in Serie A and we rate the game's greatest handball saves. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility where I'm joined by my old friend. It's JJ Bull. What's happening, JJ?
I did not expect to go first.
Oh.
I don't know what to say.
Well, you've been promoted.
Yeah. Just football.
Yeah.
What a great sport.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Good.
I like it a lot.
What would you give the weekend out of 10?
Footballs.
Footballs. Good, yeah. Good answer. Mina Rizuki, how was your weekend of football?
Well, I thought Serie A was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
We all get to it.
I did.
A lot of draws in the Premier League, weren't there?
Do you think it's of the level that it was before, or is it just a little bit predictable?
Possibly not. We're getting quite deep in... That's a deep question to be asking before we've introduced our third panellist.
I'm just in that kind of mood now.
It's the world's greatest man, Jim White. How was your weekend, Jim?
I had a great weekend, and then I went to the Emirates.
Oh. Oh, dear.
But you got to see Chris Wilder.
I did get to see Chris Wilder. What I love about Chris Wilder's right is just fantastic. Do you think you should have won that game? Nah, we were rubbish. It's brilliant, isn't it? No other manager said that. You know, Arteta comes out. Well, we deserved. No, you didn't deserve to win that.
Don't be ridiculous. Oh, Jim, you're my hero.
Well, we'll certainly get back onto Arsenal later, but let's begin our episode today by talking about Liverpool and Manchester United. Liverpool won 2-0 against Manchester United at Anfield. Chris Bascombe was there for us.
Well, it was a strange game in many ways. I think Liverpool were completely dominant for most of it. There were spells in either half where I thought they were just going to blow Manchester United away, and they had the opportunity to do so. And yet, in both halves, United also had their moments. Which they are encouraged by, but I think overall, I don't think anyone who was there will deny that there was a huge difference in quality overall between the two sides, and I don't think anybody coming away from Anfield would argue that the 30-point gap between the clubs at the moment is a fair representation of where they both stand. I think United tried to resist Liverpool, the formation, you know, playing three at the back, putting Luke Shaw centre-half, and it just shows really to me how they have got every other club in fear of what they might do to them rather than vice versa. We've seen so many teams, even elite teams now, come to Anfield, even Pep Guardiola in recent years, completely change their system because of what Liverpool can do to them. And a similar thing, and I now don't really know what clubs are going to do next, because everything they try, they take encouragement from. They come away saying, oh, we had our moments, but they still end up getting beat. So it's worrying for everybody else, because I think Liverpool are very much the team at the moment, and I actually think Liverpool are going to get even better as the months progress.
So, JJ, a slightly tougher game for Liverpool than we might have been expecting, but yet another win. The Kop now brave enough to sing, we're going to win the league. Results very kind elsewhere this weekend for Liverpool. We can decisively call them champions elect now.
Oh, right? Yeah. I mean, they've won the league. I don't know when they're going to lose another game. That's the weird thing. It's quite exciting. I quite want to see just how long they can go with it, because they're such a special team. It'd be nice if they had some all-time record that comes up. They were, even though it seemed difficult at times against United, and I think the way that Solskjaer set up was exactly right, and he almost got what he needed from it, you can just tell that they're a different class. There's something amazing about this team. It's taken that he's had the time to build it. They've recruited so well, so cleverly, and it's all come together. And it's so rare you get a combination of all those things at once, especially in this modern day of football that we get.
They're just absolutely firing on all cylinders, aren't they? Even the stadium is wonderful at the moment. They're doing that up. Like, the kits are really good. It's just really hard to fault them on any possible level. Would have been even...
I'm going to fault them.
Oh, go ahead, Jim.
I think it's a shame, given how brilliant they are and how dominant they are, that they're not going for the treble. And I'll tell you why they won't go for the treble, because Klopp doesn't rate the FA Cup. There's no point. And you can guarantee that next weekend, when they, even though the league is won by the end of February at this rate, next weekend he will play a weakened side in the cup. Go for the bloody treble, Jürgen. Well, you'll never get a better opportunity than this. Go for it. And then, you know, your mouthy fans can stop complaining about United.
Manchester United fan Jim White there. What about Virgil van Dijk? Mina, it would have been even easier for Liverpool if that goal had been given at the beginning, towards the beginning of the game, when he allegedly fouled De Gea, but I couldn't really see it myself. But in general, what a player, what a centre-back, just an absolute complete centre-back, and possibly even better than that. What do you like most about Virgil van Dijk as a player?
Oh, God, it's so difficult. This has to be high praise, because I watch Serie A, okay? And I come from like a league and that has really produced the best centre-backs in the world, but he is on another level. I think mostly because... you just always trust him. I think that's what you want from your centre-back. You just want to be able to look at him and be like, he'll handle that. He'll be fine with that. And if he doesn't handle that, then you think it was impossible to handle in the first place. You don't even doubt his ability to not do that. And it's not just what he does at the back and the fact that he's created leaders around him, the sense of calm that he gives to everyone. It's a little bit like everyone was talking about Nick Pope at Burnley. And it is that kind of thing, which is when you're so good at the back and you have also a wonderful goalkeeper, it just gives so much of a... sort of allowance to all the rest of the team to go and do what they want. But mostly what I love about him is the fact that he can be so secure at the back and then deliver these perfect vertical and diagonal balls forward, whether it was for Salah, whether it was for Wijnaldum. There's nothing to his game that you can really say, oh, but he should really be able to do that. He is good at the back. He is strong. He's athletic and able, but he's also very gifted technically and intelligent beyond what I've seen in most in the league.
It's like he's been built from like by the military to
the precision
to fight in a war or something like that. And everything he does is by like the manual. Everything he does for defending is exactly as you should do if coached. The little things like body positioning, just to try and put you off somewhere. Even so, when Martial missed that shot that I think he should have put in the top corner, but he thumped it over. There's another thing to that we can talk about. But you see, when he's hitting it, Van Dijk bends his run to come onto him and puts his foot out just where you think he'd put it low. So he can't put it low like he'd maybe want to, and he has to snatch at it. Just little things he does all over the pitch.
But also,
he's amazing.
Just seeing him outside a fitting room in a department store waiting for his other half and just carrying all the bags. It's just like he's a really good guy as well.
did you actually see that? Or
I did actually see that. No.
His combination of athleticism and intelligence is second to none. What's really interesting about Virgil van Dijk is the fact that we now can all see he's the greatest thing that ever walked. Mm. And yet, he was playing at Southampton and Liverpool were the only people who seemed to want him.
Sounds really arrogant, but I've been seeing it for ages. I saw it at Celtic. Like, it's Celtic, he was miles above. I couldn't believe no one
Everyone's
had taken him
miles
on first.
Above at Celtic.
But I do think that...
But you can tell there's a difference in some players. There's a lot of them that come through that Scottish league especially. But Van Dijk was clearly... you can tell when they're going to go from that club and go to somewhere else and be instantly better than everyone else. Same with Larsson. As soon as he went elsewhere, he's going to be amazing, because you can just tell that some people have that special bit, and Van Dijk was clearly there.
So let me rephrase it. when I said that nobody spotted, obviously, you know, you spotted it, but nobody within who had money to buy him spotted. Why wasn't there a queue around the block of every club in Europe?
I also think as good as he was, there was an element of Klopp being the best manager in the planet. And I feel like everyone, if you look around, you just think to yourself, why does no one have Trent Alexander-Arnold? I want him on my team. Why don't we have Andy Robertson? Why don't we have Jordan Henderson? Looks like he's the world's greatest midfielder, where for a long time before that, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is the guy that's going to hoist the Champions League trophy above his head. But then you look at him now and you're thinking, you know.
So are you saying that Van Dijk wasn't the player he was? I mean, he's obviously
improved
hugely.
I think he's improved hugely. And I think Klopp has this way of just turning you into a superstar beyond recognition. I'm not saying that he wouldn't have... I do think there is an element of this is what we were discussing last week about Marcus Rashford. And I was saying that he's developed on his own because, you know, you've had someone like Van Gaal before who's like, take two steps before you pass. Then you've got somebody like Jose Mourinho who's like, I need you to bully the opponent. And it's constantly different instructions. So he's never really been developed. But having Klopp there and who really works one-on-one, and you look at the likes of the fact that at Dortmund, Piszczek and Błaszczykowski were the best fullbacks. And then you had, you know, Hummels was incredible. Everyone just looked incredible under him. He does have that ability to take you just that much further and really tap into that potential.
Yeah, I think he's such a great manager at making that big move really, really good for those players who are looking to make that step up. And you compare that to the sorts of players Man United have signed, younger players for whom, like, the move to Man United, their whole career is going to pivot on that, like Wan-Bissaka, Maguire, Daniel James, Luke Shaw a little bit earlier. And you see the difference in them. Like, I mean, you know, all of them could still be absolutely fantastic players. There's a lot of potential there, but they're not coming on at the rate that those players Liverpool
have. Look at Marcel.
Part of that is to do, I mean, the reason Liverpool are doing so well now, and Manchester United are just, I mean, they're an upper mid-table team now. You can't get away from that. United aren't the same as they were 7 years ago. They are an upper mid-table. They're no better than Wolves at the moment. And Liverpool's recruitment is entirely the reason for that. It's, Klopp has turned those players into what they are and made the team. But without the clever strategy from above, there is no way they'd be where they are. And the players they've brought in are scouted so carefully and fit a designated plan. I think the guys in charge, were they not in charge of the Red Sox who adopted that Moneyball figure? So they're trying to adapt all these different statistical models that they had into a sport where it's never really been done properly. But Liverpool have found every single variable and found a way to control it through coaching and the way that Klopp's managed it, but brought in players that support exactly what he wants to do. So if he says that to support this and make this happen, we need this amount of spacing on the team, we need a player who can do this, who wins this many balls and does that sort of stuff. That's the players they found. And then whether it's through their own youth academy...
They didn't always get their first choice.
But you can form a list of players that you want, and then you surely improve those ones. Because there's not only one good player in the world, right? There'd be loads who are at the same level, and then they might look different compared to what team they go into or what they're then coached. Like, Steven Dijk maybe come on a lot since under Klopp because of his specific coaching. But it's because he also suited exactly what they needed at the time.
And the mark of that, JJ, is that when he rotates the team, there's no change.
Yeah.
You know, it's different personnel, but they fit in perfectly into what they're doing. I mean, the midfield changes quite frequently at Liverpool, but there's never a problem. I mean, Manchester United, McTominay is injured and is growing. His reputation grows with every second that he's missing.
I know, he's not available.
At Liverpool, you know, Fabinho can not play and it doesn't make any difference. And that's the remarkable thing about that team. They are a machine. And I don't mean that disparagingly. It's perfection.
I agree. And another really important thing is that when he's bought those big players that have come in, they haven't always gone straight into the first 11 because it takes time to integrate and to learn the roles they have to do within the team to make it function. They don't just throw players in and hope it works. It's everyone's taken in, like, look, Naby Keita, Fabinho, those boys especially took a long time to get in. Oxlade Chamberlain came in straight away but then came out of the team until they learned what they have to do. And that's why it functions so well. Like the Minamino, this boy they've brought in, the only player they couldn't really replace, I think, apart from Mane and Salah being two of the world's best forwards, is Firmino. So now Firmino's got someone who plays in a similar way. Like his statistics are similar, but the way he actually plays on the pitch is now someone that you can replace with Minamino and not lose that one hugely vital position. It's brilliant.
Italy, we say that a really good team is one that can change its players, like Elizabeth Taylor changed husbands.
Give us a bit of United misery before we leave this game behind, Jim. An awful lot of injuries for Manchester United. Is that just bad luck or is there something more sinister? Are some of these players thinking, actually, I'm not going to come back for Liverpool. I'm going to go because it's a slightly easier game.
It's interesting. I will come on to this, but I saw Sheffield United on Saturday. Sheffield United play the same team every week. You know, occasionally they have someone missing. And Chris Wilder's sports science is second to none. Probably
exactly.
Second to Jurgen Klopp, maybe.
But second to one.
Second to one. Thank you. Good phrase.
Thanks a lot.
But he's got his team in a position where they don't get injured. They don't. It doesn't happen. United have got a very thin squad, a hollow squad, and so therefore, when you lose players, it's significant. But they lose them for such a long period of time. They were without Anthony Martial for 8 weeks earlier in the season. That was a huge loss for them. Now it looks as though they've got their best three outfield players all out at the same time. And I think it is indicative of the fact that the complete opposite of Liverpool, this is a club that the back room is in disarray and has been for a while. Liverpool have brought in the best of the American sports approach. Manchester United have just brought in a bunch of money suckers who have drained money from the organisation. It is a fundamental. And the manager, yeah, you could start saying they might get a better manager in Maurizio Pochettino, but he's still got to fight all these issues. Whereas Klopp, it's just a unified progression towards success.
Yeah, Sam Wallace's column on Sunday, just a magnificent summary of everything that's wrong at United, and most damningly of all, still paying Alexis Sanchez £175,000 a week to not play for them. Really, really well done there. Let's move on now and talk about Bournemouth, who I'm interested in. They are really dropping like a stone in the Premier League this year. They lost again at Norwich, and one of the problems they've got are the teams around them are now looking quite good. Norwich beat them, obviously. Watford have been good since Pearson took over. Big win for Burnley against Leicester this weekend. It's getting quite hard to see them surviving, Mina.
Yeah, I think that this is... I don't know whether to feel sorry for them. I don't know what kind of view to have about Eddie Howe. I don't know what to think about everything. I think it's an amalgamation of a lot of things that have just combined to make this... stars aligned for them to fall, I guess. But you felt really sorry for Eddie at the end of the match when he came out, and Eddie, as if he's my pal, Eddie Howe, and he just looked like, I have no idea what to do. Like, he almost feels like he's tried everything. You look at the squad, and a lot of the time, the way that they're playing is more out of fear, where it's like, let's not make a mistake, let's try to contain. And they're not really imposing that attacking kind of play that we've been so used to seeing. And I think that, they don't have the youth to bring up and just be like, all right, we're going to play these guys to give some competition, because they don't have that quality that other teams can look to either. And I think that... there's been a transition in the way that they've played before. It's been, this beautiful attacking, expansive style of play to a more of a counter-attacking team. Then they've had all the injuries that the important guys that you require for these types of games have not been available for them. And so then they just can't score goals. They're not defending properly either, because that was a risk that they were willing to take anyway by going all-out attack. But then if you don't have the players... So I just... Also, things have changed in Bournemouth. And I think a lot of the time what you think of Bournemouth is that they had this love of a small town. They had, these veterans mixed in with people who really believed, let's push forward, let's get promoted, slowly, slowly do it all the right way. Let's play the style of football. And since then, a lot has changed. And I think that bringing in players, they're not necessarily going to buy into everything that Bournemouth stands for as a club and the legacy of it. And so then you have this disjointed feeling in the dressing room. And I guess Eddie doesn't really understand yet how to move it along.
They scored 9 goals in the counter-attack last season, none this year. Mm. And that's weird, because there's a marked change in how they're trying to play and how they're trying to pass through the lines quicker. Because if you're good at the counter-attack, well, focus on that, make yourself better. But you can't always be on the counter-attack. You have to control the ball a lot of the time. So what they're trying to do, I think they're trying to do, is that they're trying to move the ball through the lines faster than they have been before, but they've changed the midfield personnel. Now, I thought Philip Billing was really decent last season before he moved in the summer. It was from Huddersfield, is that before? Was it Brighton?
Huddersfield.
And he's come into midfield, so they tend to play a 2 or 3 in the midfield. Jefferson Lerma was always there last season. He played next to one of Dan Gosling, and occasionally Nathan Ake played as a defensive midfielder. This season, Lerma's the holding player, the 6, and Billing's in midfield. And though he's very good at winning the ball and reading where it's going and intercepting it, but he's not the best distributor of the ball. And his very specific statistics, and you have to be careful with passing statistics especially, but his accuracy in the opposition half is like around 70%, which if you compare to someone like Harry Winks is 86%. And I think there's another player I looked at, I can't remember who it is, but another midfielder, basically a good midfielder in that position should be able to pass the ball about 85% accuracy for you to be able to retain the ball and move it on. And because they're keeping it less, and Lerma's passing is down as well, which could be for various reasons as well, but that means that when they're in opposition half in possession, they can't get the ball in control to players like Ryan Fraser or Harry Wilson. So they then are less effective because they cannot move the ball in the same way. It also means, because, and this is a weird thing, because it's good that Billing is cutting out, he's made more tackles and interceptions than any other Bournemouth player, heaps more than anyone else at the same stage last season as well, which means they're winning the ball higher up the pitch and protecting the defence. So they've conceded less goals, fewer goals I should say, this season, but they're winning the ball higher up, which then means when they shift it on, they're winning it in a position where there's less space ahead of Fraser and Wilson on the right to counterattack, right? Yeah. So then that affects the whole way they're playing. So although they're better at defending, they are actually worse as a team. And so Howe has to make the team develop every year. Can't do the same thing every single season. But by doing it, it sort of made them worse this season. But you could also look at things like Joshua King being injured, David Brooks being missing.
Well, this is David All Brooks these, missing is yeah. a huge thing, because I think that he's the guy that you would need to play that kind of way. And without him, you're sort of relying on players who might not. Like, you look at a player like Gonzalo Higuain, and you know, he's not fast. You don't think he's a player for the counter-attack, but he's so intelligently positioned all the time that he's perfect for that. And sometimes you just need that one player who understands what to do with limited space if there is a counter-attack, or you do need to move and break the lines.
I've seen them a few times this season, and I actually saw them beat Manchester United, not the hardest thing in the world to do, as we suggested, back in September, I think, and they were fifth in the table. So I'm not sure it's a seasonal thing. I think it's a personnel thing, because that team that they put out against Manchester United, it had Josh King in it. It had Cook and Ake as their centre-backs. And Cook and Ake have both had long-term injuries. Cook's returned thinking he's a goalkeeper. So things have...
I love
things
him
have
for doing
changed
that.
It was a head knock.
things have changed there. And I think that's the problem, that it's not so much the system, it's the personnel that he's deployed for that system and he has available to him. And you're absolutely right, Brooks has been a vast loss. But Ryan Fraser's really weird. I mean, I really admire, and it makes sense what you say about why he's got less space. But this was the king of assists last year, and he's done nothing this year.
But is he able to do far more with the ball? Like, he made more passes this season than last, because he's getting the ball and having to shift it to run somewhere. He's not able to just run with the ball and go at them. And he's also been put, I mean, he changes wings from right to left. I don't know how that affects him, but he's basically built like a winger. Like, he can run and take people on the outside, but I think he prefers playing on the left and cutting inside. But he just can't do either in this team. I think it's a mixture of the players they have, the personnel, and how the system works with those players. And it has to all work for it to all combine well for it to work.
But how about Howe? Because he does seem, as Mina said, very, very downbeat.
Yeah.
And he does have the look of someone who doesn't quite know how to get out of this. If he does go, if they get rid of him, which would be an extraordinary thing to do to someone who's done so much for the club, do we think his stock has fallen because of this, or is he still this massively enticing prospect for a bigger club than Bournemouth?
Well, I think it would be a similar thing to Pochettino going at Spurs, in that it's a very talented manager who's perhaps run out of time. I mean, eventually you do at clubs if you don't win anything. I'd stick up for Howe and just say he is admirably honest. You know, he knows what he's got to do. The problem is, or he thinks he knows what he's got to do. The problem is his invariable response is, we've got to work harder. And I actually wonder whether he's pushing him too hard on the training ground. You know, there's a lot of injuries there. And, you know, right, we've got to work harder. Maybe no. Maybe you should give him a bit of a break. Let things relax a bit.
Sometimes things come to a natural end, right? Mm. Like his tenure, so after 6 years or so, however long he's been there, I'm making that number up, people just grow too familiar, and then you don't get the same out of them. And it might just be, sadly, that if he were to come away now and the ghost of Sam Allardyce came in, you'd get a different kind of approach that would then get those points you need. But also it might balance out, and you think he's fine in the end, and he's good to get them up from the Championship if they do go down. It's so difficult to know exactly what they're supposed to do here, because Howe clearly knows what he's doing, but if he knows he's not getting the most out of them, what's he supposed
They've
to do?
They've got an issue at Bournemouth in that he is everything. He's the Alex Ferguson figure at Bournemouth. He runs everything from top to bottom. You know, if you want to get an interview with a player, you ring up the press office and they say, we'll just have to check with Eddie. It's right down to that kind of level of control. So it would be really, really difficult
to see him off.
But
this is where I worry. This is where I worry about his future going forward, because he is sort of the guy that, it's a little bit like what Pep has at Man City, is that the whole club revolves around this one manager. And I think there is a part of him that looks panicked and upset as well, because this is really tough if Bournemouth go down. Their money is entirely dependent on what pretty much entirely dependent on the revenue that they get from TV deals. So what's going to happen then? Because they pay a lot in salaries. And he knows that, you know, should they go down, this is not just detrimental to him, but detrimental to the team, to the club, to what it stands for the people as well. But why I worry for him is that he's not necessarily going to have the setup going forward in any other club. And is he going to be able, is he pragmatic enough at times to perhaps put things aside? I think he's very good when it comes to talking to players one-on-one and chatting to them and trying to get the best out of them. But is he good enough to impose a style of play or when you look at these players, some of the times they're just not making the necessary runs. They're thinking about themselves. He also came out and said sometimes they're too individualistic when I would like them to put the team ahead of everything. Does that mean that he's not getting through to them in that sense? Does it mean that when it comes to actually creating a team unit that is, you know, about like, this is what we're going to do, I don't care, sort of a Nigel Pearson or, you know, that kind of guy, more of a pragmatist. Does he have that in his locker? Because I do think it's really important if you do want to reach the very top, the pinnacle of coaching these big teams, you need to have that in the locker. And I think this is the time to see what Eddie Howe can do with that. I know it's unfair because of everything that they're going through, but I do think that's necessary for your development as a manager.
I just feel like we could be heading for a catastrophic exit. Exit.
We're going to have to rewrite the pub quiz question. We're going to have to rewrite the pub quiz question because they're one of three teams never to be relegated from the top flight.
Oh, marvellous.
And they're always the one you forget.
Along with Arsenal and Everton?
Correct.
Lovely stuff. I redeem myself.
Hello, I'm Marianne Jones, and I'm the editor of The Telegraph magazine, which means I spend my week overseeing every page, from the front cover to hard-hitting news reports, columns and lifestyle features. We go to print weekly, so we have a little bit longer to craft our journalism using our award-winning writers and fantastic art and photography teams. That means we can publish long-form pieces that really get to the heart of the story. Just recently, our cover interviews with Joaquin Phoenix and James Middleton made global headlines, while our writer Mick Brown's investigation into false memory syndrome won a major press award. And the fact of the matter is, we couldn't have done all of this without our subscribers. Without them, we just can't commission the stories you like reading or make podcasts like this one. Why not try out a 30-day subscription to The Telegraph completely free? Go to thetelegraph.co.uk/audio.
Let's move on to the aforementioned Arsenal. It's drawing Arsenal at the moment. Last two have ended 1-1 against Palace and most recently Sheffield United. How will Mikel Arteta be feeling? Jim, you were there on Saturday. Frustrated with what he's getting out of his players?
Yes, Arteta is a brilliant analyst and he will work out what is going on and then he will spend a long time on the training ground trying to put it right. There's a huge gap, however, between what you do on the training ground and what you do on the pitch. And there's always going to be an issue with this squad that gap is possibly insurmountable. You can't go anywhere. This is Arsenal. So they used to have a back four that was renowned as being the Tower of London kind of strengths. They used to have Sol Campbell and Kolo Touré in the centre-backs. Now they've got Mustafi and David Luiz.
Mustafi wasn't that bad. He was all right.
Things have changed the last 15 years, I guess.
When you were talking about the good defence, I was thinking about Steve Bould. I read somewhere over the weekend that he had won an eating competition at Arsenal, like before the days of Wenger coming in and banning everything that wasn't like brown rice. And he'd won. It was a competition of how many dinners can you eat, and he'd had eight dinners.
Brilliant! That's how you
bring
make
that friend. Back.
Bring it back. He's just got a really, really poor squad at Arsenal, and he's got a lot of potential there. There's some great young players coming through. Martinelli, wow, he's fantastic, but you're not going to get much more than mid-table mediocrity on potential. Yeah. That's the problem he's got. And there's serious work. He will be putting a lot of effort into trying to analyse things on the training ground. But there's work got to be done in the recruitment department.
I think their squad's about top five, honestly.
Really?
I really do. I just think they're missing captains. They're missing two. You look at Liverpool example. Jordan Henderson is not the best player in that team by a long way. Technically not the best player at all. But you couldn't have that team without him in there because of what he brings. James Milner, again, a good player, but not brilliant. But you need players like that in the room. And Arsenal have lost that. They've lost what they had before in the post-Wenger era, and they need to bring something in, which just takes time. And I don't know if you even can bring in players that suddenly make that happen. It takes so long for someone to feel at home enough to be like, this is my club and this is how we act and set those standards.
Quick mention for Mike Dean, who notched up his 500th appearance as a Premier League referee. Do you like Mike Dean, JJ? Do you enjoy his antics?
Of course I do. I love a bit of the theatre and football. He's great. He's also a very good referee, I think.
Didn't he make a mistake in the game?
Everyone makes mistakes.
Oh. I thought it was a penalty, actually. It did go to VAR and they decided it wasn't. So obviously I was wrong. But if I'd have been refereeing that, I'd have given Arsenal a penalty.
And you'd have been wrong.
What about...
For now, JJ, wouldn't have been very different.
What about Spurs, JJ? Pretty lucky to get a point at Watford. Feels like they need to back Jose Mourinho in this transfer window if they're going to rescue this season in any meaningful way.
Yeah, the whole Mourinho thing's going at fast forward, isn't it? Oh lordy, it's going quick. He's already turned to this sort of, they need stuff to happen, something, the world's against them, referees are against them now. He's used starting to go into that zone. The I am so calm and relaxed and happy Jose disappeared very, very soon after he's come in. Watford, Nigel Pearson knows what he's doing, right? And Watford were really good, sat deep just to deny Spurs any chance of being able to break them open. They didn't really create anything, but then they're missing... You look at their average position maps as a weird way to do it, but look at their position, average position maps after the game. Watford had a clear spike at the top where Troy Deeney was playing, so you've got your depth between your centre-back and your striker, whereas Spurs just have a flat line where all these midfielders that they had on the pitch were. So they're just lacking that kind of penetrative... Oh no, I can't say that word. That spike at the top of their team to get in behind and cause any problems, and they just can't function the same way.
Do you think Mourinho's just not... Everyone keeps saying, oh, well, you know, now he's just basically gone down. Has he just stopped choosing teams properly?
He's sort of run out of them, really. But
like, as in, I'm just trying to think of, he took on sort of Juventus. I still think that we could win the Champions League.
Oh, yeah, he'd walk a league of Juventus.
Forget the league. It's Antonio Conte's Inter. But forget the league a second. But I think he'd do really well in the Champions League with this team. Is it the fact that he's now choosing sides not like that he used to, where he was used to really was like clever about, okay, I'm going to pick this team because I really think I can do it this way, you know? The way that he chose sides was with this level of, he almost guaranteed success because of what he could do. Ranieri had built this beautiful Chelsea, right? Inter was basically, that had no competitors at the time, you know? And it was like, okay, I have like lots of money to spend, so why not? Is he now going to places where, if Pochettino is not going to do this wonderful thing with Spurs, then it was probably going to be a little bit difficult for everyone.
Yeah,
right?
That's really relevant. And I also think this is hard to put in, to say without it sounding really kind of loose and weird, but I think his age matters and how he's changed as a person. So he's definitely changed. I mean, I think you saw a difference in the way he acted when he was at Manchester United, when he had lots of personal problems going on, and you can see that he just isn't the same as he once was when he was spiky and charismatic and had all this confidence. And once your confidence takes a dent like that, like once a boxer gets knocked out once, that's them, that invincibility's gone. And Mourinho's sort of in the same way.
Quickly, I know he missed the penalty bit. Can I quickly just say, big up Troy Deeney. I saw Watford beat Bournemouth the other day, and Nigel Pearson arrived at precisely the moment Troy Deeney became fit again. Whoa, has he been blessed? Deeney is leader personified.
Yeah,
and he is so intelligent on the pitch as well. His positioning, his bringing in of other players, he's a really, really top footballer. And you know, Pearson is going to succeed at Watford, and it's thanks to Deeney being fit again.
Yeah. Proper
Maybe
hero
United
of this
should go for him.
Current Watford era.
Can I just also point out, I don't think that it's because Mourinho's old that he's lost it or anything like that. I just think that he's different how he approaches it.
You've given your ages
in a way. Let's have a quick rattle through the rest of the Premier League now. And it was looking like another brilliant result for Southampton, Mina, until Wolves' excellent comeback. Jimenez, what a striker. 19 goals now this season. Should a bigger club be looking at him? Spurs or United, possibly this transfer window?
I still feel like with United, you know, it's not necessary. Oh, Rashford is out, so possibly. And yeah, he's a wonderful player. He's hardworking. It's really strange when you consider that Benfica, most of the time he was on the bench. He was seen as a guy that couldn't handle 90 minutes, whereas now he does everything, although you do sense that he's very tired now. wouldn't mind a little bit of a rest. But he is that kind of all-action guy who needs space to operate in, and you find that in the Premier League. I don't think that he's necessarily the man that I'd go for if I was, say, a big, I don't know, a Barcelona or a Real Madrid, but definitely Premier League, Bundesliga, or even the Dutch League. Play teams that like love to go forward and attack. He's the perfect guy. He's hard running, and I think Adama Traore also really helped in that change of formation.
Wolves probably a really fun team to be playing for at the moment. I don't know why I'm trying to give him away to the saddest clubs in the Premier League. What about Newcastle, Jim? An absolute mugging at St James's Park this weekend. Chelsea's inexperience hurting them a little bit again. I love a smash and grab victory like this, but then I'm a QPR fan, so my expectations are slightly different. I saw one of those over the weekend when we beat Leeds, extremely fortunately. Do you think Newcastle fans would have enjoyed this in the same way, or are they expecting a little bit more than their team to sit deep against Chelsea and nick a 94th minute winner?
Yeah, that Newcastle fan who ended up with the corner flag in his groin probably didn't enjoy it as much as that. But the noise at the end at St James's Park suggests they do. It's a really interesting relationship building at St James's Park. A manager who they really didn't trust and thought was just a joke coming in and actually delivering. That is a real thing. And what I think is really interesting about Newcastle is Rafa Benitez thought the FA Cup was a complete and utter waste of time. I remember went to see them against Oxford United. They lost against Oxford a couple of years ago, and Rafa was smiling in the press conference.
It's a cultural thing.
Thank goodness that's out of the way. Steve Bruce absolutely loves the FA Cup. They're playing Oxford United again on Saturday. They will have a full strength team, and if he delivers a bit of silverware, look, we're only at the fourth round. I'm getting well ahead of myself, but.
I love
it. It's not beyond the realms of possibility.
There's something to be said for going in with expectations that low, aren't there? Like, all he can really do is come up. The opposite of that, of course, JJ, is Pep Guardiola at Manchester City, who's probably set standards far too high there. To me, this result against Palace at the weekend just summed up that it's just not their year. Like, it looked like they'd won it dramatically late on, and then they got equalised against right at the death.
Yeah.
It's just not happened for them in quite the same way this year, has it? Which probably doesn't mean they're not a fantastic side, but it's just been a strange season for them.
No, it would be the kind of save that you would Control-Alt-Delete if we're at Football Manager and to start again and to give up, maybe start a new one with a different team. But he's stuck with the players he's got. They definitely need to have reinforcements. It's all gone wrong. Losing Laporte was a huge thing. John Stones is all out of sorts. So Guardiola was just constantly at him the whole game, trying to do little coaching points, trying to get him to go towards players and stop them. Cancelo was quite out of position, and Stones didn't go to Zaha quickly enough for the goal. Little things that they can correct, but the same mistakes keep happening, and you'd think they just need to change. It's just the end of that dominating period in the Premier League. It's maybe an end. They need to bring some new players in and kind of start again.
That nasty
Cenk Tosun.
Cenk Tosun, he's back.
I know.
He's back.
And we were just talking about it.
I loved it. I loved seeing him score. Yeah, John Stones. I mean, I think that nasty man from Port Vale has just ruined it for him.
That's what I was thinking, by the way. When I saw that performance, I was like,
Finally, Mina, there were protests at West Ham before their 1-1 draw at the weekend. Poor old producer Joel Grove struggled to get to work, living as he does in the Olympic Park. Do you have sympathy for West Ham fans?
Well, I mean, if they're going out there and protesting the fact that they've lost their atmosphere and all the money that they have to pay for this stadium, then absolutely you have to feel sorry for them and everything that's being handled. But I'll be honest, I'm not the best person to ask about this because I don't know. I'm a capitalist, so I'm always sort of like on the side of people who run clubs.
Hashtag team gold.
Yes.
What do you think, Jim?
There's a huge gap. We've spoken about the gap between potential and delivery at Arsenal. There's a huge gap between what Gold and Sullivan promised and what's happening. Mm. And until they start breaching that gap, there's always going to be issues there. It's a pretty rotten place to go and watch a football match. And when you were in love with your old ground as they were, a lot of West Ham fans didn't see there was any reason to move from the Bulling Ground. What was wrong with it? They loved it. It was in the heart of their community. And now, goodness, it's a soulless place, that.
Yeah, yeah.
But David Moyes is doing well.
Huge gap as well at the ground between the fans and the pitch.
That's the biggest gap of all, yeah.
Let's have a lovely small piece of music and a song for Europe. Mina, we've got to start with Haaland, a hat-trick, possibly. Still slightly debating whether or not it was a hat-trick off the bench for Dortmund in their 5-3 run over Augsburg at the weekend. Must be tremendously exciting for the Borussia Dortmund fans to have them, him in their team.
I mean, for us, it's a hat-trick. For Germans, it's not a hat-trick because it's going to be...
Why not? I've got to follow this.
They have to score it in one half and it has to be uninterrupted. So,
what is this? Is this a...
Seriously?
Well, this is something that I didn't know. I mean, Raph was talking about this and I was like, oh my God, I didn't know this, you know?
One half?
Yeah, it has to be in one half and uninterrupted. So it's got to be three in a row, basically.
Hang on, he scored 3 goals in 21 minutes and that doesn't count as... 26.
Imagine that.
That doesn't count as a hat-trick.
And how many would Ronaldo have, you know? But either way, what I think is so funny is that when he came, everyone was like, you know, Michael Zorc, all the directors at Dortmund were like, let's not get carried away. Let's not put too much pressure on this kid. You know, he's coming here. We've been tracking him for so long and he chose them because they are the right team to develop youth. He knew he was going to get lots of chances to play. He knew he was going to make the difference or at least make an impact and given the time to do that. Without the pressure. And so everyone was like, you know, take off the pressure. Let's introduce him. And bam, bam, bam. First ever, like youngest player ever to score a hat-trick on his debut in the Bundesliga, I think. Also as a sub, youngest ever, which is just, he's just hitting records already. You can clearly see that this is a guy who, I also think it's the perfect move for him to have moved from Salzburg to the Bundesliga. I think that was just the right thing to do. I know that all these other teams like United... I personally wouldn't have gone to United right now. I wouldn't have gone to Juve to what exactly? Sit on the bench while Ronaldo just always plays, you know? So I think that it was an excellent move for him. And now, I mean, he's really set up a case. You just go there, Jadon Sancho. Dortmund is the perfect place.
Sancho, you're absolutely right about that. If you watched United on Sunday against Liverpool, Haaland wouldn't have scored a goal.
No.
If he was playing for them. You watch the balls that Jadon Sancho was putting through for him. So he's gone to the, absolutely.
But
the
it's
right
almost
place.
Like Dortmund, that's all they've ever been missing is a Haaland because they've never really had that striker since Aubameyang left. And I thought Paco Alcacer has done a good job, but he's not that presence that you need that Haaland really is. And it's astonishing to think that now I feel like they are entirely dependent on him after like this, you know, little cameo that he made. But he is the kind of player that just ties it all together up front.
Yeah, what a start for him.
And let's see what happens.
On the theme of hat-tricks, traditional Italian hat-tricks, Immobile got one for Lazio. They've now won 11 in a row. But not so good news for Rene Gattuso at Napoli. He's lost 4 of his last 5 games. Not looking like a good appointment for them.
No, but that's not... I do feel sorry for Gattuso. This is a huge problem for them. I know, I love him, but it's a bad situation at the team. What's really strange is they went into Retiro, which is the training camp they all decided on, and then left the camp 24 hours later. So it just seems to be a bad situation with the club. They don't have Koulibaly and Mertens available at the moment. You can see that whatever they train really well, but on the pitch, nothing comes together. But on the flip side, Inzaghi at Lazio, it is turning into something astonishing to watch because physically and mentally, this is a side that's superior to practically everyone in Serie A. You look at Juventus, you even look at Antonio Conte's Inter, and they get tired. What's amazing about Lazio is that they just don't get tired. And this is Immobile's second hat-trick since 2017. I mean, that's something, you know, like it's a while since this kid has managed a hat-trick. And it's 23 goals in 19 games. And that is, it's a very, like, ask Lukaku, ask Ronaldo. No one's managing these types of figures in Serie A because it's a hard league. There isn't that pace. I mean, it's easy in many other ways, but it's hard for strikers, let's say, because everyone's always so organized defensively. But he is always cracking it, and they just hit you on the flanks or they hit you through central methods. They look at, to me, like perfection when I watch them. And then sometimes, like last week, they were just very lucky.
Finally, another team not having a brilliant season are Atletico Madrid in Spain. Shocked 2-0 by Eibar this weekend. They're 8 points off the top. What's not gone so well for them this year, Mina?
I think it's been a lot of changes for Atletico Madrid. Diego Simeone is trying to find a way of sort of knitting it all back together. But with this particular one, they were basically out Atletico Madrid. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just done by a team that is Eibar is like a mini Atleti in the way that it's got all action. It's super energetic, super intense. Imagine playing a Klopp team. And when you don't have Koke, when you don't have, who is very good going forward, but also excellent in covering for his teammates, there's no Kieran Trippier at the moment, no Jimenez, there's lots of injuries for them. And he's sort of, it's a thin squad, so he's trying to tie it all together. And when you are facing a side that just harries and presses all the time, it was going to happen. They're not a side that's ready. There's been a lot of change. Obviously, they lost the likes of Diego Godin over the summer. They lost Griezmann to Barcelona. So it is a rebuilding process. We saw them in summer and thought, wow, they're already perfect, but it's always going to take some time.
Finally, I'm going to ask you a question, JJ. Steve Cook added himself to the pantheon of outfield players making ludicrous handball saves at the weekend at Carrow Road. What is the greatest example of this from football? We got some good responses on social media, but I'm going to wait and see what you're all saying because I fear some of them might be doubling up. What have you got, JJ?
They're definitely not going to double up on me. The only thing I can really think of from this was when Jim Leighton got kicked in the head in the Scottish Cup final in 2000. In about the third minute, I think it was. And Robbie Winters, ever heard of him before?
No.
No. He's a lovely striker who played for Aberdeen for several years, but he had to go on goal because this was before they were allowed five substitutes in a cup final game. So this they changed the rules shortly after. Aberdeen, pioneering as ever, ended up getting gubbed 4-0. But yeah, that's why they changed the rule in Scotland, so you'd have more than three subs in the cup final.
Pioneer. How about you, Mina?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me before, Jim, because I think that we might have the same answer, is, of course, Suarez.
Jim, yeah, of course.
It's got to be Suarez.
It's got to be Suarez against Ghana in the World Cup. And that was the moment that I thought he was a world-class player, because if you're that desperate to win, I love it.
When that happened, it was like, you know when you've had those discussions with people about, like, what would you do in this situation? You know you're going to give away the penalty, but you take it because you might save the penalty.
Yes, exactly.
I was so happy that had finally happened in a match.
Yes.
And it completely worked. And there's that wonderful shot of him like sticking around just on the side of the pitch, dawdling to see the penalty save. I'm loving it.
Became a national hero in Uruguay as a result of that. And an absolute villain in Africa. Everyone across the continent loathed him. And this was before he'd met Patrice Evra.
Who he wrote to apologise, we should
no,
say.
No, Liverpool wrote to him to
apologise.
All
right, well, that's, you know.
Liverpool Football Club wrote. Yeah. I don't think Suarez has ever contacted him.
Look, I think we're all Team Evra there, aren't we?
What were the responses? Were they all Suarez as well?
David said Suarez versus Ghana has to be the most important. He also uses the word iconic, but as we know, that word is banned from this podcast. Zappa said Oxlade-Chamberlain versus Chelsea has to be one of the most bizarre stroke, again, regretfully, iconic. And Concord Sports says Mario Kempes, and this is not debatable. So there you go.
What was it? I once got sent off for handballing on the line.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you do it on purpose or was it instinct?
No, I did it on purpose because they were going to score otherwise. Regrettably, they scored from the penalty I was sent off.
Oh, no. What minute was it in?
It was the second half.
See?
It was a long time ago.
It makes you world-class.
Who were you playing for?
I was playing for St. John's College Middle Common Room.
And what was the final score?
Oh, they absolutely hammered us. It was something like 5-0, 6-0.
Left common room just for too strong. That's all for this week. You can get in touch with me before next week's episode if you would like to. It's completely up to you. Find me on Twitter, @Tom_Gibbs. Send us an email as well. We love an email. We had a good one this week. I'm going to look for it now because I forgot to print it out. From Thomas Kearney, who said, Re-Nina's comments, Nina, this week about the Spanish clubs needing the cash from their Saudi Arabian ventures to catch up with the Premier League. The latest rankings from Deloitte show Barcelona top with €841 million, then Real Madrid €757 million, then daylight. Yes, it was greed, but let's not justify it. Very well said, Thomas. More like that, please. afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We will read out the best of what you send us. Don't forget to subscribe to Audio Football Club. Just look for Audio Football Club in the sort of podcast section of the internet and take it from there. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.